hardly a boring time. it's a thrilling time. There are constant thrills, albeit some of them rather terrifying. And everyone in this Europe is part of that. We've gotten in our vehicles and made it up the dirt road to the top of the mountain, so to speak. So we can enjoy the realization that this earth is our altar, that the rains are not part of nature only, but are also created by human action, that the weather patterns are in response to culture and civilization, that we are no longer separate from this that we're sitting in and sitting on. We go up to the latrine, and it doesn't flush what we leave down into the Hudson River anymore. There it is, our own leavings. And in a way, you know, I go, oh God, you people are paying $40 to come up to sit in a portalette. Oh dear. We discussed that at the board meeting last night. The fact that it is primitive up here. And yet, I always laugh, relative to a year ago, we think it's luxurious. Any of you who have been with us, and some of you have for several years, when Dick was here, we had one 30-foot trailer at the back of the land, and that was the office, the kitchen, my personal dwelling space, the dining area, and one teepee down in the canyon. That was 2 years ago. A year ago, everything was in that 30-foot trailer. Now we've got a kitchen, we've got a hot shower. A year ago, we didn't have a hot shower. And so these little improvements really make a difference, not only in your experience, but in our experience of being here with you. And we determined that we would do as little on the land as possible, because the land has something really important to teach us city dwellers. We've been cut off from that teacher. And that we don't want to lay concrete and asphalt all over this ridge. That you who live in more civilized circumstances need the nourishment of being in a situation where 60 cycle per second coating isn't giving your nervous system a particular buzz. And where people who live, who usually go to bed at 7:30, that's my real exception and my body feels it, where the kind of vitality of living with the cycle of the day and the cycle of the moon and the lunar cycle in terms of the length of the day and the night, where people who really live that way, you know, we're not talking about the vision, by God, we're living it. Where you can feel us a little bit, and the kind of special energy that you bring from being in a rich and civilized area comes in contact with us beasts, us creatures of the land, and where we can come together and there'll be a marriage between these two realms of culture and nature. So I'm doing personally everything possible within my own self in terms of personal work to recondition myself or condition myself to living primitively and to being open to a level of life that I was definitely not trained for, having been raised in Coral Gables, Florida, in a debutante society, and schooled at Columbia University, and you know, many years in New York City, and so on. But many years as an anthropologist in Africa and the Americas, in Mexico and South America, living in huts, and saying, there is a virtue to this kind of more simple life. And creating being part of a group that is trying to make this a gateway, not an island, through which people pass so that they can take what we have here back to where they are. I don't think that Los Angeles should move to Ojai. I think people should take what we have in Ojai and take it to LA and bring what's in LA up here, and there'll be a good flow and exchange between these two sites. Because Los Angeles, and many of you are from LA, needs to be renatured. And we need your energy, your brand of vitality. Hi, Marilyn, come in. Great. So I'm doing my introductory. So do we. I was just saying that we had our, the reason why I'm hardly in my body and my eyes are all bloodshot, we had our annual board meeting last night. And actually, I'm so high off of those slightly burned out because I was saying that it, on the board, we have Dick Price, who's co-founder of Esalen. But this is all coincidental. These are all people who have counseled deeply and have come onto the board. Jack Zimmerman, who founded the Heartlight Community, both of whom are here now. Mm-hmm. Peter Caddy, who's just voted onto the board. Naomi Pollack, who's Center for Healing Arts and Traveling mm-hmm. Jewish Theater. And myself and Bob Ream, who's been part of the Human Dimensions Institute now, the Ojai Foundation since the beginning. And Elliot Lombard, a lawyer who dances with one foot in a boat and the other foot in a canoe. But a really great New York lawyer who gets in a plane twice a year, flies out here to represent that head. And he's a broker in the sense that many people here are brokers. You've got one foot in a boat and one foot in a canoe, and we're doing really, really well with that. And this place, like you, we're a boat and canoe people. I want to give you a little bit of background about this place and then a little bit of background on how to be here. Because there are a few rules that are important. Dr. Annie Besant came here in 1927 and was guided to buy this land. She was president of the Theosophical Society, the spiritual mother of Krishnamurti, one of the greatest feminists, probably the feminist of her time, a woman deeply involved in the decolonialization of India, a great orator and teacher, and an extraordinary person. She saw the Ojai Valley as the cradle of the coming civilization. She saw certain things happening on this piece of land, which none of us knew about. These things that were predicted in 1927, but which in fact we intuitively became channels for part of that manifestation, and we're in the primitive, barest beginnings. She indicated that this would not happen, it didn't begin to happen until the late 1970s. I wasn't given this mandate until I'd been here a year and a half. Those of us who came together to help chemicalize the situation were amazed that we were being dragged, kicking and screaming in the right direction.
She also said it would be built on love and sacrifice, and she wasn't kidding.
But that either one.
Really, it has been truly that. And so we feel really good about being here in the sense that it's hard to do what we're doing. We've all been challenged to our boots. We've all given up everything. All the money I made in New York working for Joe Campbell and McGraw-Hill and at Harvard where I have an appointment and traveling around writing books, it's all gone in here because you put your money where your mouth is. You know? Okay. The way interest rates are today, you better put your money where your mouth is or it's bullshit. That's what it boils down to. And so we're really trying. We're also in the inner situation, and it's becoming more and more evident. We talked about this last night. It's a kind of non-attachment. We're here by virtue of another foundation who is lending us this land. And it could be taken away from us tomorrow or today. And as we go into our third year, that sense of, are we really able to go through another year of this degree of uncertainty? So I say, well, so what's certain about the general situation anyway? We're just sharing the field of uncertainty. And what do you do in uncertainty? You move forward with a great deal of determination. When I told, years ago I had an audience with Dalai Lama and told him about this vision that was working through 3 years ago that I spent time with him. He said it will take three qualities for you to develop, individually, collectively, in order to accomplish this task. And these are qualities that are indicated in your book and that I know you know about, but I had never been given them so succinctly. And he said, I'm sure that you like them. That is the teaching for you. This is something you must develop. He said, great luck. I can see you have it. Great persistence. that I feel there inside of you. So the last one is great patience.
I'm too young to be patient.
So I'm really learning patience because living on land teaches you that more than anything. It's not the snap world. It's not the world where you put, we don't have a computer up here that, you know, helps organize our life. You can't push a button and have instant results. The garden gives us a sense of pacing. The rains give us a sense of pacing. And the interaction of living in a salaryless situation where everyone here is a volunteer and works full time and some people have not a dime gives us a sense of great patience. In fact, everyone who works here and lives here full time pays $100 a month to cover their food costs. So, I mean, it's outrageous. But we feel that such a place is important not only in our life but your life. And that this is a place of miracles. And you make it possible by coming to programs, by coming here and working, by donating money, by some, Victoria Kingston Mudd donated that big old funky office trailer when we had not a thing here. And you are a participant in the dream. And without you, it cannot be realized. So it's great not to be in a position of power, but in a position of saying, hey, we're in this thing together. Now, being here requires that you do the following things. If you want to smoke, even though it's been incredibly rainy, just to keep together with the rhythm of the thing, you can smoke either in the gravel in front of the trailer or in your car. Okay? Second thing is, with regards to water, the elements, that every drop of water that you drink here is brought to you in bottles by one of our people here from the spring. So we ask you to become really conscious of your water consumption, both of what you drink, which will be in the little dispensers around the land, and also of what you use to wash your hands in the very spigots, because we don't have a Casitas water connection where you just, you know, turn on infinite water. We have a little generator and goes boom, 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 and it draws water that's highly mineralized from the ground of our well that we have here. So please take all the water you need, but come into the realization that it is, in this system, and really in your system, a finite resource. We do not have a bank of flush toilets, but you can be involved in your instinctual functions up the hill and to the left, where we have two portalettes and a pit latrine that is actually my, you know, the nicest of the three facilities that are immediately available here. And if you use the pit latrine, it's like a wonderful kind of wooden closet and leave the door open. You have a beautiful view of the valley. you just follow your leavings with a little line and ashes, and that's right by the John. We'll have a nice break for luncheon, and the food that you'll be eating, I think we're having, we usually have just raw food here. Most of it has been grown in our garden, so that you'll literally be eating the place. And that's really important, because you find out that makes a difference in your life. When you eat, in fact, a friend of mine, George Condominas, wrote a book called We Eat the Forest. When you eat of the place, you become it truly. It really is your body. We encourage you deeply to walk around on the land. Don't just sit gabbing. Part of your time here is being here on this earth. And there's a wonderful road that you can walk up that's pretty dry right now. We've had, you know, about 36 hours without rain. And it goes right up the hill and on the ridge and goes back into just an empty wilderness place. And I encourage you to walk on that. There are paths on the land. Walk on those paths and enjoy the oak groves. However, the poison oak, he said, I overcame my poison oak by experiencing it as a beautiful woman. So
if you're ready for that,
go right ahead. If you don't know what poison oak is, ask the staff. We've got Jim and me and Gigi back. back there in the lavender and turquoise, and then the rest of the staff and Madeline Clifton will be happy to show you what poison oak is. It is a really strong medicine, plant medicine feature. So, we are not going to have our program tomorrow, but we will have the program with Joseph Campbell on Tuesday. So anyone who's interested in Ministries of the Grail with Joe, please register now because we're just about at our top limit. And then on Wednesday, Lita and a group of us will be going to the Southwest for a 10-day pilgrimage with Navajo and Hopi peoples and in archaeological areas. And then our programs will resume at the end of April with Gail Laughingbird and Gyaltso Trungpa Rinpoche, who will be doing work on healing in the Tibetan Book of the Dead. And then we're off. Again, the programs will see wilderness in May, and then a real strong program in June, and then 2 months in the summer where we take off, and then again in the fall we gather. So it's a great pleasure in synchronicity that all of this is happening at the moment you're coming. Because your book has been a Bible for all of us and has guided us to each other. And I think, in a way, that it has been the single most important manifestation that is either visual or auditory or written, literary, in this whole world of breakthrough. From one epoch that's lasted approximately 150,000 years. I mean, it's longer than just the Paleolithic. I think it started with Shanidar in the Middle East. And it's one great mythological age that's coming to an end, and we're at the limit, the threshold, the new birth of the new world, and sharing the shakiness of an epistemology that is barely formed and formulated. And Marilyn had the courage and the insight to speak to people who knew they were dancers on the edge, and to say it in such a way that we could hear her and hear each other. And it's thrilling that there are a number of those people today here who are in the book as voices or as standing behind the voices, and that all of us represent ourselves and groups who are sharing in this vision of what is and what is coming, and who are living it. Truly. So have a great day.
Thank you. I'm already loving being here.
Thank you.
What a neat place to be going. I think what I'd like to do before I get really started is to get a little bit of a sense of who you are and your interests and what it is that you already know about the Aquarian conspiracy, so that I know how much context is needed. So first what I would like to do is find out how many who are here have read all or any part of the Aquarian conspiracy, so you have some familiarity with it. Okay, that's most people. My suspicion driving up was I've got these different sort of classifications of groups with sort of subtle gradations. There are the people who are the real captive audiences, where somebody on a program for some national convention has managed to put me over on the whole group and brings me in, and you know, I'll sock it to them knowing that many of them are just going to freak out. I had a real difficult audience recently where somebody brought me in to speak to an entire school district in a very depressed part of Michigan of all of the teachers, elementary and high school. The district had laid off everybody who had been hired after 1971, and there was this sense of great deadness and despair. And I found that school teachers have a very poor attention span. That was not an easy group to work with. Sometimes, as in, I spoke to a group of industrial relations managers in Vancouver, B.C. recently. They were wonderful, best captive group I ever talked to in terms of their openness and their response. But my real favorite group is to talk to hardcore transformation junkies. Because I can make real leaps in my own understanding in the course of doing that. And I especially like it. I have found that when people are on a retreat, that's even better because they have left behind something of the old environment and they have committed themselves in a different way. And this is almost a retreat. I mean, having found our way up here to the Ohio Foundation, given us kind of a sense of commitment. It's not like dropping in at a lecture at UCLA.
Yeah.
And that's neat. Also, having all day is special because it lets me be real nonlinear, knowing that I can really cover almost everything that I want to cover because there's time to cover it. Part of having hardcore transformation junkies as the audience is that it has to do with the phenomenon that I have come to think of as getting. And my friend and associate Perry, who is here, there, jacket, started this with me in talking about sometime last fall. Perry, who sometimes does body work, was doing body work on a mutual friend who was himself a real wonderful and serious body worker. And Perry said afterwards that it was great working on a master getter. And I knew what he meant because I had discovered in having body work done that all the first couple of years, I think, that I would get some occasional body work from this other friend. I let him do it to me. And it took a while, and I think it was not until I started doing it stoned that I fully realized that you had to get the bodywork, that the person doing it could only do so much for you. And then there was a place in your own consciousness where you had to move into the space where they were working, and sometimes through pain, to get it. And then months later, I had another thought about that. I suddenly realized that it isn't that being a getter has to do also with learning and therapy and everything like that. That Don Juan can take us to the edge of the cliff, but you got to jump yourself. And that we have a tendency in our culture as consumers of education, consumers of products, consumers of what we consider information or wisdom or entertainment or anything else, to think it should be done to us. But that the key is the being able to do that last 5% of work yourself, to be able to move through uncomfortable spaces or to strain for an idea or an understanding, to open up more than to strain, I guess, to be willing to stay with the... sometimes people will tell you something that seems like a weird idea, you know, and it's very strange. It's a perspective you never thought of, and it's kind of strange. Part of being a getter is being willing to hang out with that, to see if maybe there is something of merit there. And that what I began to realize is that some groups of people I talk to, like recently I did an all-day seminar for 150 graduate students at JFK University, and they were people in a master's program in transpersonal psychology, ages on the average 30 to 35, real serious about what they were doing. And they were great getters, you know, and so it made a really wonderful day. And that's what I like about a group like this, is that you are ready to be synergistic with whatever it is we do here today. And although at times I'll just be going on and on without stopping for questions or comments, from time to time, I want us to interact. So if you have a thought, a question, a comment that you want to put in, make a note of it, and then we'll kind of do a whole lot of that sort of dialoguing and then go back into the other. The reason that I don't just say, well, interrupt me anytime with questions, is a lot of time I feel like there's a stream of something going and I don't want to stop it because I don't even know where it's coming from. Okay, so it's going to be pretty nonlinear, and we're going to be talking about... Are there people out there who want to come in and find a place? Because maybe let's stop long enough for that. I want you to know from things that people tell me after and during lectures and seminars. So if you say something real wonderful and you find it being quoted, you may be being referred to as somebody I talked to at Ojai.
You
just a kind of a quick overview for purposes of context. For those of you who have not, there are several of you who have not read The Aquarian Conspiracy. You probably have some sense of what it's about. But let me kind of net it out so that we can move along and explore in different directions. The book came out 2 years ago. It has been in paperback since last November. There are about 200,000 copies in print, which is a lot for such a strange book. And it recently tickled at the bottom of the New York Times bestseller list. Didn't quite get on, but got mentioned as a runner-up, which I thought would never happen. People on the Eastern Seaboard don't know about this here revolution. It'll be all over, and they'll wonder what happened. And it's especially offensive to them that all this stuff is happening in California. There's this, it's sort of bi-coastal competition. I wrote The Aquarian Conspiracy out of some observations. I mean, what triggered it initially were some observations I was making in the mid-70s. I had written a book that came out in 1973 called The Brain Revolution, and it was on mind and consciousness research and brain research with a definite bias toward the mysterious rather than just a cut-and-dry kind of approach to the brain. Out of that, I found, well, for one thing, I found that the reason nobody was keeping track of the research in this area. It was really, like I think Joan would confirm this, in the early 70s there was a lot happening, but there was no place where people were saying what it was. So you had to be a detective to find out about it. And I found that in researching the book. I was frustrated, and I thought, who is keeping track of the news in this field of the exploration of what's going on in people's minds? There were some lovely journals, like the Journal of Transpersonal Psychology, so on, but they came out twice a year. So kind of out of a sense of necessity, I must say I have kind of been sucked into everything that I have done. It isn't that I think, oh, I think it would be a good idea to do so-and-so. It's like, oh, somebody needs to do that. Heck. Or as one friend of mine says, oh, shit. So in 1975, I started publishing Brain Mind Bulletin, and we brought some of those, many of you here are probably familiar with our newsletters, but for those who didn't, we brought some free samples so you can get a look at it. And Brain Mind is about the research in the area of consciousness, learning, creativity, sleep, dreams, altered states, on and on. And what we were trying to do there was kind of synthesize, to see the patterns, to kind of be pattern connectors for people who were trying to get some sort of understanding or gestalt of what was going on with human consciousness. In The Brain Revolution, I covered such a wide territory, and in there was a kind of an emerging picture of this new mind. But it seemed like we still need to do more acknowledging of the fact that there is this whole new dimension of consciousness and reality that is emerging for people. The Bulletin, because it was the only publication trying to keep up in a news coverage way with the consciousness revolution, began getting a lot of information that was really not quite our territory. Because what it was about was social transformation coming out of this new personal vision that people had. And so people would tell us about a humanistic law network, or they would tell us about that they were trying to do this thing in the political system or this thing in business, and so on and so forth. And I tried to shoehorn it into the Bulletin, sneak that stuff in, but it was not quite right for the Bulletin. It was some whole other territory. I also had personally been involved in a number of alternative projects, I guess you would call it, in writing some environmental legislation that came out of just trying to keep a freeway from going through a neighborhood park. I ended up being involved in Sacramento and so on. I was part of a community group in Los Angeles of parents, teachers, and some older students who talked the LA school district into starting the first public alternative school, a K-12 school. And I had a sense of, and also because of the clearinghouse that we were tied in with people involved with holistic health, and humanistic, this, that, and the other thing. Okay? So I had been thinking that when I got the bulletin safely launched, what I wanted to do was to write a book about these emerging choices and alternatives in the society. But it became increasingly obvious, the more I thought about it, that in fact, these were not separate alternatives, but they reflected some deep underlying shift of values and seeing that was happening. I wrote an editorial for an early issue of Brainline Bulletin called The Movement That Has No Name. And I was saying that there was this thing happening, and it was paradoxical in a way. It was something that we didn't have any historic precedent in the society for, and that it was very hard to talk about it. And people referred to it as it. People were saying, and those of you who were involved at that time will remember, people said, boy, it's happening. It's happening faster. So-and-so is helping to make it happen. And this it was this kind of whole constellation of change, of new ways of thinking about our health and new ways of thinking about learning and who we were and relationships and everything else. And I remember I said in that editorial that maybe it was too soon to name whatever this was that was going on. You know, as the Tao that can be named is not the Tao. Whatever can be told is not really it. So what happens but a few months later I named it. And how it happened is that it popped into my head one day that the people I knew, my buddies in all of this, people like David Bresler at UCLA and Ken Pelletier and various people around the country, Judy Scutch, who was then in the East, in their bringing different groups of people together, in their sneaky work within the system, and their touching establishment people and so on and so forth, that in fact what was going on here, and I knew that some of it was happening in other countries, it was transnational, was just popped in, a conspiracy. Okay, it was certainly, it had its sneaky elements. You know, it would be like, you're trying to put across an idea to someone or to some group. You know they are going to be scared to death of it because they will think it's something else or they won't know what it is. So what you're trying to do is discharge their fear. To find a way to introduce your ideas that isn't going to scare people off before they get a chance to try it out. So people would be doing things like they would be sharing their strategies. They'd sit around at little groups and in the halls at conferences talking about how to talk to so-and-so and what worked. I remember that Ken, for instance, had put in a proposal to a granting agency. He wanted to study the neurophysiology of health. And he got turned down, so he resubmitted the same proposal under the title The Neurophysiology of Disease, and it was accepted. So it was a kind of, if we're going to play this game, and we're going to play it with the people who can make a difference in the establishment, in positions of external power in the world, and touch them, we need to know how to do it without scaring them. And so what is the language? How do we translate this into unthreatening language? Rather than to be stubborn and stick with our own esoteric language, whatever our own particular esoteric jargon happens to be, and not get it done. There is a saying that I evolved for myself some years ago, which people say is real valuable to them if I share it, so I will share it with you. If a thing is worth doing, it's worth doing half-assed. Now, what that means is not that you shouldn't have standards and integrity, but that what happens a lot of times is if we hold out to be perfect in what we do, it'll never happen. It's like the letter you're not going to answer till you can really take time and write a really thoughtful response, so the individual never even gets a postcard from you. And if this transformation is worth doing, people began to realize, it's worth doing half-assed. Meaning that even if it gets translated and filtered and somehow comes out diluted, what it is you want to do, it's a beginning. You know, it's the one little candle that it's better to light than curse the darkness. And so what people were doing is they were finding ways through. They were finding access and windows. And these were people who knew that you had to have your act together. You had to have your professional act together or your particular craft together in order to do it. That we have had a reputation to overcome that all visionaries are flaky and don't understand the real world and cannot be pragmatic. So that a lot of what was happening was people who really had their acts together to the extent of being able to be convincing and talk to people at any level were finding ways to do that. And examples of the kind of conspiratorial techniques would be, or sharing of strategies. Dolores Krieger, who is a professor of nursing at New York University, some of you may know Dee, wanted to study the phenomenon of healing, particularly the laying on of hands. She knew that making a proposal to do the laying on of hands in hospitals in New York City was not likely to get accepted. So she called a therapeutic touch and managed to do her original experiments along those lines. And now, as a matter of fact, therapeutic touch is taught in hospitals and nursing schools all over the country, all over the world, probably. A fellow who was a civilian consultant to the Navy, I mentioned this in the book, some of you may remember the story, he was brought into the Navy to try, as part of a leadership program where they were trying to give the troops a sense of their own power. And so he was supposed to come up with strategies, ideas, and techniques. So what he wanted to do was to teach everybody to meditate. But he figured that wouldn't go over too big. So then he thought of Herbert Benson's technique. Herbert Benson totally laundered transcendental meditation at Harvard into something with entirely secular, and called it the relaxation response. But then he thinks, wait a minute, they're not going to want to relax military. That doesn't sound good. So he called it dynamic methods of coping. It was hugely successful. And it ended up being in the whole going into the program for the Tri-Services Administration, being available throughout the entire military, because he was able to do that. And people were sharing resources. They were sharing good connections, contacts, people in the government who were friendly, people in the media who were friendly, and supporting each other, really cooperating. People, for instance, who were working in holistic health, finding ways to help people who were working on the changes in education. And it really was a kind of conspiracy, but I had some trouble with that myself because I thought all the conspiracies I could think of were bad. I strained and finally thought there is the surprise party, which is about as close as you can come to a positive conspiracy. But all the conspiracies we've talked about are like to hide evidence, to fix prices, to take over governments. They all had to do with holding on to power, manipulating power, grabbing power. And this crazy conspiracy was to give power away. You know, it was this plot to make things work. Now, nothing wrong with that, except I couldn't figure out any precedents for it. So there was a week where I was kind of brooding about whether or not to use that title, because I thought, I don't want people to be offended or to think this is negative or a spy novel, which many people do. Robert Ludlum's new book. And so I thought about it, and you know how it is when you're casting about and you get a little help here and there. I picked up a little book I had never read that somebody gave me. You know how people will give you books and the time they give them to you, you're not ready to read them? I remember somebody gave me Krishnamurti's Freedom from the Known. I took one look at it and said, yuck. 2 years later, I picked it up and I thought, God, how did he know all that stuff? So I picked up this little book, The Savers of God by Nikos Kazantzakis, and just leaped. And suddenly there was this paragraph looming out at me that said, I hope to say a word in time to my companions, a signal, like a password or a signal, like conspirators. Let us unite, let us merge our hearts. Let us make for the earth a heart and a brain. Let us give a human meaning to the superhuman struggle. In fact, there's part of it in there which I didn't quote in the occurring conspiracy where he talks about, you know, lest that if we could do this, if earthquakes or comets or other things didn't intervene, we could really pull it off. At that time, he didn't know about nuclear holocaust. But, I mean, he did acknowledge that something might interrupt this process. The next day, very next day, in the LA Times was a headline, Trudeau urges conspiracy of love. And it was a talk Pierre Trudeau was giving to a conference, a UN conference in Vancouver, a Habitat conference. He was quoting from Pierre Teilhard de Chardin, the great Jesuit priest and scientist, who did most of his writing in the 1930s and 40s. It was never published during his lifetime because the Catholic Church at that time would not allow it to be published, but after his death, of course, became very influential. And Teilhard had written in the 1930s, interestingly enough, it was after a visit to California and then on a boat to China that he wrote this. Was, I think, the first time he talked about that if anything was going to save the society, it would be a conspiracy of men and women of goodwill. And so I realized that there was indeed some precedence for this. Also, I had thought about what does conspire really mean? I don't know how many of you here play with going back to find out what words really meant, but it is a wonderful game. If ever you are bored, just pick up the dictionary and look up a few. Because the original meanings were usually, it means to breathe together, to conspire. The original meanings of words usually have much more power, and you see what it was we really meant by it before it got off into some abstract place where we hate it. And anyway, conspire meant to breathe together. And the original meaning of conspiracy or conspirators was not negative. It was to be in harmony. I talk a lot in the Aquarian Conspiracy about the fear of the changes that we're going through. Because one of the things that slows down the process of building a new society with more caring and more creativity and more personal power is because of the tremendous fear that we all naturally have of a new idea. And we don't think about it, but we're sort of new idea phobics. And in our lifetimes, we don't notice as a pattern, usually, how it felt when we went through whatever changes brought us to where we are. What happens is something comes up in our life, a stuck place in our life. We are forced, try as we might, we are forced to make some kind of breakthrough to another way of thinking. But we so quickly integrate that new way of thinking that we think we always thought that. So that we don't notice that each time we have fear. Therefore, we go through the same slow process of resistance every time. And we don't, now, those of you who are here, many of you have learned not to do that. But it's basically kind of this great human secret that hardly anybody ever noticed, except here and there in some saying that we quote but didn't really believe. But hardly anybody noticed that, in fact, whenever the saving idea comes up, we fight it. We don't jump in and say, oh, isn't that wonderful, just what I needed. Well, I use as a model in the book, and a lot of times we're talking about Thomas Kuhn's idea of the paradigm shift, P-A-R-A-D-I-G-M, paradigm, from the Greek word paradigma, which means pattern. It's a pattern shift, which means it's not just another thought, but it's a whole, like if you're looking at a kaleidoscope, and suddenly the whole thing rearranges itself, and you have a whole totally new pattern. And Kuhn, who wrote a book called The Structure of Scientific Revolutions in the 1960s, he had made this discovery while trying to understand the history of science. He was a science historian. He could not understand why did the ancient Greek philosophers, who were such smart guys, believe what seemed to be such weird stuff about physics. Because, I mean, from his perspective, how could they not have understood that it was not in this, what he considered simplistic view that they had. And they had almost, it was what we would consider to be a pretty primitive view. And suddenly he realized that they had integrated into that view everything they knew up to that time. It was was as smart and wise as you could be at that time, given what you already knew. And that, as a matter of fact, that could be said of where we are at any time. You know, we have advanced our understanding of physics a considerable distance since the days of the ancient Greeks. But probably 50 years from now, physicists will be 20 years from now, will be looking back and saying things like, isn't that cute? They were looking for quarks. They didn't understand it was the mind of God or whatever. You know. But whatever it is, it'll be another perspective in which our perspective will look very limited and quaint. But Kuhn got that all of our theories are partial.